Welcome, everyone, to the Faith Recovery Podcast. I'm Kent.
I'm Horse. I'm Nathan.
That's Nathan over there. We are seeking to recover faith by recovering the faith, and we're in a series on John, themes in John. And last week, we started a theme that we'll finish today, called An Israelite Indeed, the Role of Israel as a Nation in the Salvation of the World. Now, Nathan, do you remember where we left off last week?
I wish I did. We didn't get very far. We got basically into John 1, I think. We talked a lot about John the Baptist as kind of the embodiment, representative for Moses in the Mosaic system. Mm. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. And
there's no one greater than John.
Yeah.
But those in the kingdom,
Greater than he,
yeah.
Yeah. And we talked about the difference, you know, between law and grace, and that grace came through Jesus Christ, and that grace has become not just God's mode of dealing with us or the system by which we will be evaluated, but the thing that we live by, right? It's grace that, you know, we have received of his fullness. Mm-hmm. And so John talks about Jesus as being the unique bearer of the revelation of God, as being the one who's come from God. And that kind of brings together several of the themes that we've talked about, as Jesus as the Word come from God, Jesus as the embodiment, the incarnate expression of this relationship. So the law of Moses, as John treats it, is that it is it's a description of truth, and so there's truth in it, but it's not the truth of truth. You know, so when we...
It's not base reality, as we talked at some point about.
Right. Yeah. So when we see the word true, what we mean is, in English, we mean factual, right? We mean correct. And when they saw the word true, and this was inescapable just because of the way their language worked, in terms of if you were reading this in Greek, what you see is something that is real, the thing that's of substance, the thing that is base reality. And the reason I say that is because our word for truth is a positive statement. You know, it comes down from Latin, like veritas, right? So it's an expression of something that's accurate, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas the Greeks had it was a negative particle in front of to be covered or veiled. So
aletheia,
right, is to be unveiled or uncovered.
Unveiled,
right. And so truth from a Greek standpoint, and language affects the way we think. when they heard that, they're thinking in terms of that which has been uncovered. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we talked about how the Greek concept of this dualism, right? That there's a reality that's the real, you know, and that we're in an expressed reality, something that's not the real. Mm-hmm. We're in the simulated. And so the writers of the New Testament, being really products of a Greek culture, a Hellenized culture somewhat, as well as products of this Jewish culture, have the idea that God is in the real. You know, it's not a realm of abstract forms, but a realm of base reality where God lives. Mm-hmm. Whereas we are a projection of that base reality, an expression of it, an extension of it. But we are not at the base. So Moses, the Mosaic Law, is in, you know, a description in words of what is real. Whereas Jesus comes to bring truth, right? Actuality, the experience of what is described by Moses. Mm-hmm. So law can describe a way of living, let's say, you know, what the law described. Grace is the reality of it. Mm-hmm. But how does someone embody the reality? You know, how does someone transfer that? By definition, when I communicate, I have to break what's real, the ideas in my head, let's say, into a code. I encode it and then I speak it in words. Mm-hmm. You know, then you have to receive those words. Those words are not the thing that's in my head. They are only an encoded version. Mm-hmm. And then you have to decode it, put it in your head. Now it's not the same, of course. So it is with the law. You know, where it's an inescapable truth that law and even written revelation can't possibly express the heart of God. And that seems to be what John is saying. That the only way to know God, and we talked about a couple of episodes ago, the difference between these words of knowing, mm-hmm. you know, the way to really know somebody is to spend time with them, to watch them, to see their behavior, mm-hmm. To have these personal interactions with them of some sort. And so that was the importance of come and see. I guess we're just doing a recap. At any rate, but John, at the same time, he doesn't want to discount the law. And that was always the dilemma, I think. You know, you can hear Paul when he's writing, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. he'll say something very pejorative about the law.
Mm-hmm. Then he'll say, but I'm not saying the law is bad.
Right. Yeah. The law killed me. Not that it's bad. Mm-hmm. Not that that's a bad thing. You know, I mean, it just, it's like nobody ever talks about the good thing that murderer ever did, you know. But yeah, it's very much kind of a guns don't kill people, people kill people kind of a thing, I mm-hmm. guess, when it comes to the law. The law being a very effective gun or a sword, I guess, in the idiom of Scripture. And so maybe Paul would say, you know, swords don't kill people, people kill people. Mm-hmm. And the law is a very sharp sword. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that the idea of a sword, or maybe let's say a scalpel, right? You know, it could be a good thing, but in the wrong hands or without a surgeon, right? Without skilled hands behind it, then it's deadly. Mm-hmm. So Jesus comes to be the great physician, the one who can truly not just be this embodiment, but someone who can actually teach the Scriptures, you know, mm-hmm. the intention, be the revelation of the Scriptures. Mm-hmm. So John doesn't abandon the Old Testament. As he presents Jesus, he presents him as very Jewish. You know, while in some ways he's transcending Judaism, he's also the embodiment of Torah, mm-hmm. right? So let's just maybe think through some of the places where the Jewish system is referred to throughout John. You've been going through it some. What can you think of?
Oh, my goodness.
On the spot, baby, buddy.
Well,
post-production.
You know, like if he's the bread of life, and he's likened to the bread of the manna that came down from heaven.
Yeah.
Is that an embodiment of Torah? Or is that, that's a story told in
right.
Torah.
Yeah.
But that's an event that occurred. Mm-hmm. That God did for Israel.
Right.
It's not the written code.
Right. Right. Well, it's a written story, though. I mean, for them, they experienced it as something written. You know, they'd never eaten manna. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Yeah. That's good. Great, great example of a place where Jesus is really dealing with Moses in John 6, mm-hmm. right? So here are these Israelites, and what they want is, for want of a better word, a charismatic experience. Mm-hmm. You know, if you've been in a religion of ritual for long enough, especially, I don't know, I came up very legalistic, and we were very explicit about that those things don't happen anymore. That, you know, the religious tradition that I got into, I say, when I was in my teens, was the product of a deistic movement, really, of the Enlightenment, and this idea that everything is cause and effect, and so there's really no room for God in a closed system where of cause and effect. Mm-hmm. So God is one who, he's the primary cause, and for us, we would say, well, on very rare occasions, he'll pop in, you know, in a parenthesis, maybe. He'll mm-hmm. intersect this plane of cause and effect with something supernatural, as he did in the life of Jesus and in the lives of the apostles, but that was intended only to bring about a rationalistic revelation of God in a written book that is the New Testament. Mm-hmm. Once the New Testament was completed for us, you know, we saw it that way. And so our belief was once the New Testament was completed, the time for those things was past, and we shouldn't expect anything supernatural, that God operates through quote unquote providence, which is just the natural laws playing out somehow in our favor. And so that was the religion that was formative for me. And because of that, I really identify with, and maybe I project upon people who were in a more ritualistic approach to God when Jesus shows up, you know, because Jesus almost seems to indict them. And we talked about this, but for expecting miracles or wanting miracles, and at the same time for being surprised by them, mm-hmm. you know, he's like, I did one deed and you all marveled. It's just like, what, you know, why would this be something that just blows your mind, you know? Mm-hmm. And so here are people who haven't seen this kind of a thing. You know, God doesn't come here. Mm-hmm. You know, we've been showing up and you know, keeping all this lit for him, and he's not here, but now he's here, right? and so here are people who are in a ritualistic relationship with God, and yet they're reading stories about their ancestors who encountered a lot of things that were very supernatural. And there has to be tension, something mm-hmm. disparate for them. So Jesus comes and he says, you know, they want to experience that. You know, they don't want anything new. You know, they just want to be Israelites. They want to be like those people. They want him to come and and endorse their ritual, to invigorate it, you mm-hmm. know, to give it life. And instead, he transcends it, almost. He doesn't discount it, but he just shows that those things that they're aspiring to, the experience of Moses, let's say, mm-hmm. are too little. They're too small. That why they have this high aspiration to somehow encounter the experience of Moses, the experience of David, to walk in their shoes, you know, to see what they saw and do what they did. Jesus is like, you guys are, you're asking for too little. You expect too little. You want too little. You should want more, you know, that Moses, that even in those great, you know, expressions of who he is, of who God is through Moses, were still just shadows and forms. What you want are flashy forms instead of maybe more pedestrian reality. So he tells them, you know, they're like, hey, Moses gave us bread to eat from heaven, right? Mm-hmm. The funny thing is that, you know, they're just like, man, if we just had bread from heaven like they did, this would be amazing. Everything would be amazing, mm-hmm. you know. What's ironic about that, do you think? They're just like, hey, just give us bread from heaven, you know, and we'll be happy. Go.
Well, the people weren't happy in that story.
Right? That's the whole point of the story.
Yeah.
You know, God can literally feed you by hand and you're still going to gripe and moan.
Uh-huh.
You know, that there's something broken. There's something that you're still hungry for.
Mm-hmm.
You may not even know what it is, mm-hmm. but he can feed you literally by hand.
Mm-hmm.
and you will turn and gripe and complain. You know, this is the irony that, and just as I was saying, if I, you know, when I try to express an idea to you and I have to encode it, you have to take it, you dismantle the code that I'm, you know, putting out there, uh-huh. and then you're reassembling it in your head. Okay. What did they do with the Old Testament? You know, they read it selectively. They read it in a partisan way. Okay. Uh-huh. Here are people who are under Roman occupation. There are people who are affected by tribalism. Right, they're very sure that they're the best people on the planet, and that God is surely going to come and vindicate them against the Romans soon. Right, mm-hmm. and that means a lot of dead bodies in the streets. You know, it means a lot of blood and just a final decision in favor of Israel. Right. So when Messiah comes, they're thinking, okay, he's going to affirm all of this, but this selective reading of Scripture it made it so that when Jesus comes, that they're maybe inclined away from him, right? Mm-hmm. He says, look, what I want to give you is my flesh and my blood, you know? I want to give you my flesh to eat and my blood to drink.
Yeah.
And like, could we do something that's a little, you know, a little less intimate here? Yeah. I mean, this is...
Isn't that the point where it says, and many people turned away from him at that point?
Right. Right. And I like that. I like that vignette or that story for lots of reasons. And again, even that story it's set against the backdrop of the Passover. And this is all in John 6. John 6 begins, when the Passover of the Jews was at hand, Jesus was in Galilee. Now, that's important for a couple of reasons. One is, he's blowing off the Passover. Two, he started his own competing gathering out in Galilee, not Judea. Okay? Mm-hmm. So there are people, not just him, but thousands of people who've not begun their trip. Because it took some time to get down there, right? You pack up your whole family, everything, get to Jerusalem, okay? And now he's almost having an alternative gathering in the Galilean region. So this is, he's not making a whole lot of friends down in Judea, right? It almost looks like there's some sort of a coup forming up in Galilee, which had to be a real concern, I think, for the Judean Jews, because here they are. They've got, you know, they've got it pretty good, right? You know, they kind of have a special dispensation from Rome. Rome's tolerating them, giving them a degree of religious freedom. They've got quite a bit of power over worldwide Judaism from this spot, okay? The last thing they would ever want is for somebody to come and take away their place in nation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? Now, up in Galilee, they don't have as much. You know, they're very religious. You know, they're close enough, but they have their own kind of ideas, their own kind of strain of Judaism. Just like the Essenes, right? There were people who would flee the center of the religion to find pure Yahwism, right? Mm-hmm. To find something more, something less compromised with the Gentiles. Okay, so there was always a concern, I think, that here are these Galileans that are going to be coming into town, and they're going to start a revolt, and this isn't going to be good for anyone, right? So here are all these Galileans. I think this is some of the subtext. Here are all these Galileans out in away from Jerusalem as Passover is approaching, and they're talking about more of a wilderness motif, you know. Which recurred, why John the Baptist is in the wilderness, right? Mm-hmm. John the Baptist is very much like the sect where we get the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Essenes that moved out into the wilderness. Even the Christian movement, you had the Desert Fathers, people who need to get away from the institution to find God, right? So here you have somebody, it almost looks like Jesus is encouraging this thinking, you know? We are the pure Judaism. We're the wilderness Judaism, right? And as the wilderness Judaism, if we're going to mobilize soldiers, you know, every army travels on its stomach, right? So bring us, give us bread, you know. And there's, I mean, there's some sacrifice. You're out in the wilderness without provisions. You know, it couldn't have been too terribly long, but you're hungry, right? Mm-hmm. So they're really asking, they're asking for a lot of things. It's kind of a loaded request, I think, when they ask for that bread. But a lot of it is they just want to live this life. They want to live this life they've read about, not this grind of do everything like you always have done it and live and die, but saddled with some responsibilities, you know, but really see the hand of God, be a part of something big, okay? So here's Jesus, and instead of just saying, well, you know, it's not time for that or whatever, you know, instead of putting them off, he tells them, no, I have come to bring you bread, you know, but the bread that I give is different, kind of also like the living water, right, in John 4. So this lady in John 4, this, the woman at the well, she has some background, some knowledge of at least the history of the patriarchs. This is Jacob's well. You know,
are you greater than our father Jacob who drew from this well?
Right. Yeah. And his animals. which is a reference to Jeremiah, which is probably what we should talk about. So remember, I said that Isaiah 55 is almost, I don't think we can overstate the influence of Isaiah 55 on John.
Yeah.
the companion passages are Jeremiah 2 and 3. So John, and again, I assume that this is the beloved disciple. We have no way to prove or disprove that,
mm-hmm.
okay? Except that whoever it is claims to have been in his inner circle, beloved by him,
mm-hmm.
near him, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so either this person is somehow, they may be telling someone else's story, you know? But it seems that they're claiming to be probably one of those three, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we know it's not Peter, and James is dead by the time this is written. It only leaves really one person, okay? But so let's say it's John the beloved disciple, right? Mm-hmm. Whoever this is so versed, I think, in philosophy and the scriptures. You know, either that or, again, you know, or they're inspired, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is probably, you know, both, I guess. I don't think inspiration has to be an either or. But there's Jeremiah. So remember Isaiah 55, it begins with this invitation to come and drink of the waters,
mm-hmm.
right? And then we're going to talk more about this as well, but there's this water theme that's running through the book of John, right?
Yeah.
But John really, without being super explicit, he makes these side references to Jeremiah, where he says that my people have committed two sins. They have forsaken me, the spring of living waters, and they have dug out for themselves cisterns, right? So in Jeremiah 2:13, my people have committed two sins. They have forsaken me, the spring of living water.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So Isaiah 55 says, come drink of the waters, mm-hmm. right? That are flowing.
Right. Yeah.
What are those waters? Hey,
those are living waters or spring waters,
right?
Or flowing waters,
which is God himself.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. God's like, I'm the spring of living waters. I don't just give living water. He said, I am living water.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And he says, they've forsaken me, and they've dug their own cisterns, broken cisterns that cannot hold water, right? Is Israel a servant, a slave by birth, Jacob, right? Why then has he become plunder, right? Lions have roared and people have growled at him. So here's this indictment on Israel, but Israel as the expression of this man, right? Why do you go to Egypt to drink water from the Nile, you know, or why do you go to Assyria to drink water from the Euphrates? Here are people who are thirsty, you know, and there's this kind of indictment that water's available, but you're not choosing to have it. You'd be rather to just dig a hole in the ground for water to build up in rather than to go. And he says, although you wash yourself with soap, here's this water theme again, you're unclean, you're thirsty, here I am, you know. Living water. I'm here to clean you. I'm here to slake your thirst. And so there's this indictment. Now, it doesn't seem that John specifically quotes any of this in Jeremiah, right? But it seems to run implicitly behind all of this.
Jesus speaks to the woman about living waters.
Mm-hmm.
So that seems to be an allusion to Jeremiah too.
Right.
Because in Jeremiah, it's Jeremiah who speaks of living waters.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, but not only that, but the indictment is on really the temple, you know, mm-hmm. people who've created this religious system for people to come and encounter God,
mm-hmm.
right? But it's human devices. It's of a human making, and so it can't hold water.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that Israel has come to resort to political alliances and, you know, these interpersonal mechanisms of control in terms of, you know, having a militia that protects the sanctity of the temple,
mm-hmm.
you know, of leaders who are leaders because they're willing to get in bed with kind of a dirty dealing emperor or a local, a regional governor. And so this becomes those waters, right? And so at any rate, but he refers specifically, he talks about how, that there's going to be this indictment on them or this judgment on them. Let me see, I'm trying to find it real quick. But he says that, you know, that they're going to, he says, surely the idolatrous commotion from the hills and the mountains is a deception. Surely in the Lord, our God is the salvation of Israel. From our youth, shameful gods have consumed the fruits of our ancestors' labor. Remember, this woman is thinking about her ancestor, right? Their flocks and herds, their sons and daughters, right? Let us lie down in shame and let our disgrace cover us, for we have sinned against the Lord our God, and we and our ancestors from our youth till this day, we have not obeyed the Lord our God. This woman is, she's trying to stand on the shoulders of Jacob, you know, when Jesus comes. And he and she mentions he came and he drank from this well with his flocks and herds, right? So there's this connection. And again, also he's depicting Israel as this unfaithful woman, this serial adulteress. He says, but like a woman unfaithful to her husband, so you too, Israel, have been unfaithful to me, declares the Lord, Jeremiah 3:20, right? So this woman kind of becomes this embodiment of somebody who has an ancestral connection, okay, to God. But this ancestral connection to God, just like we always do, right? We always build up our ancestors and forget to see their flaws. But the whole point of all these stories is to say, look, you know, they had everything you want, but they're not doing it. You know, they didn't follow God in purity. So if you want to go back to what they did and who they were, you're going to go back to their mistakes. You're actually living out their mistakes even now, right? You're the full flower of their failures. And so Jesus comes to bring new wine, right? New living waters, a flowing stream. I don't think it's coincidental that Jesus uses this stagnant purification water in man-made cisterns, as it were, you know, stone pots, to make into wine. You know,
yeah,
this is a new thing.
Yeah,
you know, so here are people who are concerned about purity, right? And they're looking to physical water to make them pure. I mean, the reason that this water was in stone pots is because Torah teaches that if a dead bird falls into water in a clay vessel, you have to break the vessel. But if it falls into a stone pot, or is somehow that water's in the pot is defiled, the water is defiled, but not the stone. So this is why it's made out of stone, right? So there's this concern about almost a quarantine mentality, whereas Jesus comes and he just turns this basically wash water into a beverage, you know, to drink. So it's a very new and different thing he's doing, but it's also the outgrowth of that. It's all taking place. And again, you know, while most of what, at least in the earlier chapters of John, so in the first six chapters of John, everything's happening in the Galilean region. Jesus is making periodic trips to Judea. And we almost are like, it's almost like we are just camping in Galilee, and we're hearing stories of all the stuff he did in Judea. You know, the camera doesn't go to Judea in the early parts of John. That we only get this little side reference, like, and when they had heard of all of the powerful miracles that he had been doing in Judea, they crowded, you know, around the house, or they came to find him. But John doesn't tell us about any of those things. He doesn't actually go, you know, he makes a brief trip, maybe in John 5, and John 2, he goes, but we don't see a whole lot of miracles happening in Judea in those stories. We see this one thing with the guy at the Pool of Bethesda, which kind of is almost the beginning of the end in John. it's really when the sentiment turns toward putting Jesus to death. Mm-hmm. And which is, it's very much a choice of those cisterns over the living water. Because here you have, again, somebody that's walking by a stagnant pool, waiting for it to move. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's other references to that specifically. But it's all to live out what was said. Mm-hmm. So that nothing can, while Jesus is coming to bring the new thing, he's doing it according to Scripture, which becomes kind of the theme. What's important is that while, you know, the Jewish people would say, well, you know, we're the ones keeping kosher, we're the ones following the law. Whereas the Christian sect would say, but we're the ones living out
the reality.
The reality.
Yeah, right, of what the law pointed to.
Right.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So, you know, we're actually drinking this living water, you know, we're eating this living bread. Mm-hmm. You have stories about it.
Mm-hmm. And you commemorate those and you perform the rituals that commemorate those, but you don't enter into the reality. The reality is standing here before you.
Right.
And you're rejecting the reality because you are fixated on your religion, your mm-hmm. practices and rituals and traditions.
Yeah. And even at its fountainhead, even at its very best, you know, it didn't satisfy the need in the human heart, mm-hmm. you know. The need to be truly transformed, the need to receive the glory of God in our character and our personality, not just to be impressed mm-hmm. from a distance. So I think in John 12, so just kind of fast track some of this, because there are, to your point, let me before I get to John 12, because really after John 12, John 13, there's this Passover, you know, this final Passover mm-hmm. that's happening. But I don't, even then, something shifts in John 13. Because when John says, and now the Passover is at hand, I don't think he's talking specifically about the Jewish feast. Yes, the Jewish feast coincides, but he's talking about the actual offering up of the Lamb of God is here, is come. Mm-hmm. So John 13, really, we begin to walk in this reality of that the first 12 chapters were preparing us for, right? This actual expression of everything. Mm-hmm. So John 1 through 12, Jesus is teaching about Torah. He's teaching about reality. He's teaching about his own coming death and all of that, right? John 13, it really gets into the events, like the events mm-hmm. themselves. The things were prefigured, but now they're coming about. They're mm-hmm. coming to pass, okay? So, at any rate, John 12 kind of begin. It closes this kind of treatment of Torah, I would say, in Jesus' teachings. Mm-hmm. But leading up to that, let me just kind of walk through. I'm going to just kind of make a little dotted path, I guess, of some of these Old Testament references leading up to John 12. Okay? So in John 2, Jesus goes to the Passover. He knocks everything over, right? But then he says, I'm the temple. You know, yeah. Tear down this temple and I'll rebuild it in 3 days. Mm-hmm. Okay? So Jesus comes to be the temple himself, right? John 3, I'm the serpent on the bronze. I'm the bronze serpent on the stick. You know, I'm the embodiment of sin and healing in one image, mm-hmm. you know. And then John 4, Jesus comes to be the word that comes down to fulfill the purpose, right? To do his will and fulfill his purpose, and that's his food. He is the, he supersedes both the Samaritan concept of God, which seems to be this almost ancestor worship, and the Jewish concept of God, which is, Jesus says, correct in its actual details, but incorrect in its intention. So there's that. Then there's a definitely a heads up conflict in John 5. Jesus heals this guy at the Pool of Bethesda, and really makes this there's an irony there. Okay, so the whole question is who's keeping Sabbath, right? Mm-hmm. And this guy who's been laying there for 38 years is the Sabbath keeping champion of the world, you know, and something's wrong with that, you know. And so Jesus fixes that, but then that there's this really pointed encounter. You search the scriptures, you think that in them you have eternal life, but they point to me, right? So this is Jesus. He's really coming kind of at the establishment, the Jewish establishment. And from then on, he's kind of persona non grata, right? He already kind of was, I guess. He's in flight for his life in John 4. John 6, you have this alternative kind of Passover in a way that is out there in the wilderness. Jesus says, I'm the bread from heaven, which, like, to your point, everybody leaves. Then John 7, he sneaks into Jerusalem, and then he pops out, you know. But this is the Feast of Tabernacles, and Jesus begins to speak of giving living water again, right? You know, if you believe in me, from within you will flow springs of living water. So he's continuing to use this kind of Moses wilderness motif. Okay, and there's an extended dealings with the establishment as he has these debates first with a body of skeptics in the first part of John 8, and then with quote-unquote believers in the last part of John 8, and they want to kill him. This is all happening in this one visit at the Feast of Booths, mm-hmm. right? John 9, he heals a blind man just in the environs of the temple. Right, just down the hill from the temple, the Pool of Siloam, or he tells the guy to go there, so he can't be too far. It's a blind man, right? So he's in the environs still of the temple when he does this. Again, this is a heads up conflict because it's on a Sabbath, and so there's all this debate. They decide they're going to kill him. John 10, Jesus speaks of himself as the good shepherd. And again, I think that this brings together this Moses reference and the David reference. You know, Moses is a shepherd, right? He spends 40 years shepherding sheep, right? And then God sends him to shepherd his people. But David is also shepherd, mm-hmm. right? And so Jesus says, but I'm the good shepherd. I lay down my life for the sheep. Mm-hmm. And that's how I'm different, mm-hmm. right? John 11, then not a ton of Old Testament references that I'm aware of. Jesus has this time where he raises Lazarus from the dead. And then that really becomes kind of the beginning of the end. And it is, it has, again, this temple cult is always in the background, right? In response to raising Lazarus from the dead, the Pharisees have a conclave. But they get together and they're like, you know, what are we accomplishing? Everyone's going after him. If he goes on like this, what is going to happen? You remember? What are they afraid of?
You alluded to this earlier. They're going to come and take away our place in our temple.
Yes. They're coming to take away our place in our nation. The Romans will come. They'll take away our place in our nation. Mm-hmm. You know, who are they afraid of? Mm-hmm. And so that, to me, it makes that moment where we kind of hear their conclusions to all this, it really makes explicit what's been implicit this whole time, mm-hmm. right?
This is about maintaining our place in our nation. That's what we're about.
It's looked like religious righteous indignation until now.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
Now it's just naked political self-interest, mm-hmm. right? The truth of it is, you know, when things really get acute, you actually see what's really in somebody's heart, what's really moving them. You know, they're getting concerned about Sabbath. Let's kill them because of Sabbath. Let's kill them because of this or that, you know. But that hasn't been enough to actually move them. Mm-hmm. You know, there's all these rumblings and intentions. There's, you know, they send soldiers to actually get him. But those guys they're not committed to capturing him. You know, they decide to not and they go back. So it's very difficult to marshal enough motivation, cohesion to actually arrest this guy and do away with him, mm-hmm. until he raises Lazarus from the dead. Now something's shifted and they're like, look, it's us or him.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, and that's always plenty. That's plenty of motivation to actually go ahead and carry out an act of violence. Mm-hmm. Once you get down to it's us or him, you know. So everything's become acute by the time we get to John 12. Okay, Jesus has raised Lazarus from the dead, and now he's hanging out in the region of Judea. Man, it's just, you could just cut the tension with a knife, mm-hmm. you know. And this woman comes and she makes this offering, this alabaster jar, she mm-hmm. pours it out on him. And then he's walking in the temple. And we know that Jesus here, so Jesus went to this fall festival of the booths, okay? It seems to be the same year. Jesus retreats to the wilderness outside of Judea. He's not far after the events of John 9, okay? And so he hears of Lazarus and when he's out in the wilderness mm-hmm. around Judea, okay? He waits it out. Lazarus dies. He comes in. Been in the grave 4 days, right? So he meanders back, and now he's just a mile from Judea. He can basically, I mean, from Jerusalem. He can just basically see it. There it is, you know? And he's staying with Lazarus's family, okay? And now, so enough time has passed that another festival has come upon them. Mm-hmm. Okay, so people, Jews again, are traveling from all over. They're in the area. The city's on high alert. This concern over Rome coming. You know, every festival was an opportunity for Rome to maybe just decide to wipe them out, right? It seems that this festival, you know, we're told that it was the festival of dedication, right? So this is Hanukkah, which you don't see a whole lot in the New Testament, you know, but here it is. And Hanukkah was a celebration of a military triumph. You know, if there was going to be a revolt, mm-hmm. it would be during Hanukkah.
Yeah.
You know, like the...
I forgot. Is it like the Maccabean revolt?
It was the Maccabees, right. Yeah.
This is like a few hundred years before their time. This is not 1,000 years before their time. This is kind of recent history.
Yeah, 150 years ago. So, yeah, when
this Antiochus, is not ancient Jewish history. This is recent Jewish history.
Antiochus Epiphanes comes and, you know, defiles the temple. And, you know, he just runs roughshod over their religion. And he finds out that that's a bad idea.
Right. Yeah. The Maccabees come and, and cleanse the temple and drive out the Romans. And they celebrate this.
The Seleucids. Yeah. And so here's... World empires realized, you know, with Cyrus the Great, they're just like, it's not worth it. Uh-huh. It's not worth it to run roughshod over people's religion, you know. Uh-huh. There's just no win. Uh-huh. I mean, even if you defeat them, they're dead. I mean, you're not ruling over them. They're just dead, right? Uh-huh. So what good does that do you? So at any rate, and the Romans had learned that. They were like, just let them do their thing, you know. Yeah. But, yeah, the Seleucids didn't. But, you know, no matter what the concessions the Romans made, there was always a zealous sect of Israelites that are like, we need these Gentiles out of here. So we get to John 10. And in John 10, 22, we get this festival of dedication. So not John 12, John 10.
Yeah.
You get the festival of dedication at Jerusalem. It was winter. Okay, so the feasts are dotted through John, right? And even to the point of this one. But what I like about this is that so it was winter and Jesus was in the temple courts walking in Solomon's colonnade. So Jesus, it seems, according to John, in this last year of his life, makes Judea his home base. So he goes to the winter festival in John 7, mm-hmm. right? And the Feast of Booths. And then in John 10, he's still there by the time December comes around. Right. So Hanukkah, the Feast of Dedication in 1022. We know it's Hanukkah because it's a Feast of Dedication, but also it was winter. Right. And he was in the temple courts walking in Solomon's colonnade. The Jews who were there in the English translation, it says they gathered around him. OK. The Greek has more of a sense of they besieged him. Right. So here's Jesus. He's kind of the embodiment of all of this. And they kind of come as this invading army Kind of like, you're not leaving until we get what we came for.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it's confrontational to the point of like, this is the moment. You're going to do what we want you to do, right? It says, they besieged him saying, how long will you keep us in suspense? If you are the Messiah, tell us plainly.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is that feast of dedication, celebrating the Maccabees, like we were talking about, right? Mm-hmm. And it's when people are like, look, you know, we've been patient.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've been here for a couple of months. You've been spouting this stuff. You've been alluding to it, right? But everybody's here, right? And we're ready. So come and do it, right? And then, you know, then he goes on and he says, you know, and then he goes on to talk about how his sheep hear his voice, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so this shepherd mentality, again, it goes back to David. And so, and then, you know, he says, I and my father are one. And again, his Jewish opponents picked up stones to stone him. And he says, you know, I've shown you many good works. For which of these do you stone me? And it's like, we're not stoning you for any good works, you know, but you, a mere man, claim to be God. So Jesus is, he's talking about how that there's a revolution coming, but it's something far different from what they're expecting, right? But it's still connected, you know, somewhat to their history. All of this is taking place in Jerusalem, in the temple, as was foretold. So, at any rate, you know, that there's this military aspiration, this aspiration for temple in place, whereas Jesus is saying, look, I'm calling a flock together out from among everybody, you know, I'm not defending a border, right? I'm moving and I'm calling and they're coming out
mm-hmm.
to join me. So here's this difference, right? So Jesus is again, he's fulfilling the prophets, but he's not doing it in a way that they want it or that they understand.
Mm-hmm. It's like he's renewing Israel as the prophets prophesied God would do, mm-hmm. but he's not renewing political national Israel. Rather, he's calling forth a new people who will be the true Israel.
Right. Well, and, you know, it, again, all John doesn't, just like we spoke about how Heraclitus, the philosophy of Heraclitus was that someone who's truly speaking as an oracle is not necessarily making everything explicit. Right there, mm-hmm. it's an invitation to come and attend and to unpack.
Mm-hmm.
And Jesus and John, as he's writing, he's very implicit about the things that he's saying. Okay, so he's really referring to the prophecies in Ezekiel, especially about how God is going to shepherd his people,
mm-hmm.
right? And then he says it, and that shepherd will be David.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so here's this Jesus is saying, I am. You're looking for David.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's really what they want.
Mm-hmm.
And he's saying, I am David.
Mm-hmm.
but if I tell you explicitly I'm Messiah, I'm going to be walking into what you think I'm supposed to be doing, right?
Mm-hmm.
So here they are. I mean, here are people who are, they're the same as the Romans who came to besiege Jerusalem. You know, they come to besiege God,
mm-hmm.
you know, to demand from him mm-hmm. what they want. So they're really no different. You know, they want God to side with them, the good people.
Right.
But they're exactly the same, you know, as the Romans. It's just that they have different clothing and different culture, but their heart is the same.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And Jesus is calling them to something more. So that, and then we get to John 12 when Passover's coming. But I wanted to just go to John 13 because I said something shifts and then we'll get out. Okay. So Passover's coming in John 12. Now, Jesus has had Passovers, but here John's talking about, he's using the definite article. He's like, it's time for the Passover, you know. And this is, it was just before the Passover festival or the Passover. Jesus knew that the hour had come for him to leave this world and go to the Father. having loved those who were his own, who were in the world, he loved them to the end. And then we go into that. The evening meal was in progress. The devil had already prompted Judas, the son of Simon Iscariot, to betray Jesus. Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power and that he had come from God and was returning to God. Again, Isaiah 55. So he got up from the meal, took off his outer clothing, and wrapped a towel around his waist. And he poured water into a basin, began to wash his disciples' feet and dry them with a towel. So here's Jesus, who's very, very secure and grounded in who he is, taking this place to serve. But this is all by way of him becoming the Passover lamb. And so really, I feel like, at least my understanding of John is, from John 13 on, we really have more of a actual depiction of Jesus embodying these things. Mm-hmm. You know, now he's healed some people and stuff like that, but here's Jesus stooping to serve. Here he is preparing to be crucified and things like that. So mm-hmm. the reality of it is coming, and Jesus is preparing his disciples for this moment. But all that to say is that all of this is woven around the Old Testament. It's a fulfillment of it. John puts so much effort into alluding to the scriptures that, you know, if for someone to think, well, he's discounting it or whatever, it's not that. But I do believe, and to the title of this talk, that what Jesus has come to do is to come to bring the reality of Israel, right? An Israelite indeed. He's equipping people to become this aspirational Israel, right? Mm-hmm. The true Israel, the one that is that's changed by an encounter with God, that living with God in their midst in this wilderness walk. So
wilderness walk. Thank you, everybody. If you got questions, you can email us to discussion@recoverfaith.org, and we will see you next time.